Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today's, we're going to start the Spring 2024 issue, It's Revolutionary, Choices in Conflict, Volume 63, Number 2. The first article is a letter from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association Program Coordinator, Jessica Pratt. Hey, y'all. Surely the people across our state during the American Revolution knew they were living through an extraordinarily important era and witnessing crucial events, right? The calls for freedom and the pushback against revolution surrounded them. But they also made time to enjoy a favorite meal, trade news with neighbors, watch trees sway in the wind, and maybe pet their dog. Everyday things. Did they expect that 250 years later, people would want to know about their lives during this time? Could they have guessed that their letters would be preserved in archives, or that their things, some special and some everyday objects, would be displayed in museums for visitors learning history? And what about the experiences of people who were not reflected in the papers and objects collected years ago? What can we learn of their lives? If the people from North Carolina's past were given the opportunity to choose, which objects might they have considered most meaningful to tell their story? We know that history, big and small, is made every day by everyone. And that means you are a part of history right now. What will capture the attention of future historians in a museum or in a history club? What objects tell your story? What makes you and what makes us, us? Commemorate the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution by starting a conversation and discovering something new about your family and friends. There's a photograph of Jessica with a caption, Here I'm examining some of the reproduction artifacts from our education collection that we use to share the stories of everyday life during the revolutionary period. Next, the introduction to this issue is an article called It's Revolutionary, Choices in Conflict by Jason Stroud, who is a historian specializing in revolutionary America and the early republic, especially North Carolina. He is assistant professor of history at Greensboro College. If you saw the fall 2023 issue of the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, you learned that the American Revolution in North Carolina was far from a straightforward struggle for freedom and independence. In fact, it was messy and complicated. Believe it or not, the issue you are about to read will complicate things even more. Why was the revolution so complicated in North Carolina? Didn't all North Carolinians want their state to be part of an independent nation? If not, why not? The answers to these questions can be found, at least in some part, in the articles in this issue. What you'll see is that some of the ideals we associate with the Revolution, such as independence, liberty, and freedom, meant different things to different people. For example, in the time of the Revolution, nearly 25% of the people in the colony were enslaved. These men, women, and children paid close attention to the rapidly changing situation during the Revolution in North Carolina. They knew that the colony's revolutionary leaders, many of whom were their enslavers, were fighting for their own liberty. Many enslaved people tried to take advantage of the chaos of revolution to seek freedom themselves, or at least to improve their lives. In 1776, patriots from North Carolina, patriots are colonists who opposed Great Britain's control over the colonies, joined delegates from other colonies. Delegates are people acting for others, such as a representative to a convention or conference, in signing the Declaration of Independence. After this, North Carolina became a state, united in struggle against the British with the other former colonies. But you will be surprised to learn that even then, many North Carolinians still actively supported the British, or more accurately, opposed the revolutionaries. These folks, known as Loyalists, colonists who supported the British crown, fought in large numbers against the Revolution. Some of the most important and bloody fighting actually pitted North Carolinians against each other in a bitter fight known as the Tory War. At one point late in the war, Loyalists under the command of legendary or notorious partisan fighter David Fanning even captured Thomas Burke, the governor of the Revolutionary State. It's hard to know how many Loyalists there were. At the time, it must have seemed to the state's revolutionary leaders that they were everywhere. But North Carolina wasn't lacking in revolutionary spirit. The state sent thousands of men to fight in the Continental Army, and many more served in the militia. These included free and enslaved African American men whose sacrifices helped gain independence for the new nation. So North Carolina society was divided in many ways by the Revolution. This fact made the conflict in the state bloodier and all the more traumatic, not to mention complicated, for its inhabitants. But after the war ended in 1783, they must have united in looking ahead to a bright future, right? Again, the answer is complicated. We can see in the state's response to the new federal constitution that was developed at Philadelphia in 1787. When it first came time to ratify or approve the new document, North Carolina at first refused. This tells historians today what must have been crystal clear to people at the time. North Carolina's population was almost as divided politically as it had been during the Revolutionary War era. Maybe it's not so surprising that North Carolina's experience in the Revolutionary era was so complicated. After all, North Carolina was a very diverse place, and people in different situations experience events in different ways. One of the jobs of historians is to explain what happened during this time, but they also try to go a few steps further to deepen our understanding of why things happened and why people responded to them as they did. The articles in this magazine will shed light on these important questions. As a sidebar, historical reenactors. Historical reenactors, people who enact or portray events from the past, help bring history to life. Throughout this issue, photos of reenactors give us insights into some aspects of the Revolutionary War. Reenactors strive for accuracy in the clothes they wear, the things they use, and how they portray events from long ago. Many reenactors volunteer at historic sites or for annual reenactments of major battles or other events. They enjoy the communities that form around these activities. This photo shows how everyone is welcome to reenact. And there are captions to a couple of photographs. This map shows the original 13 colonies in 1774. Can you find North Carolina? Compare this map to a modern map of the United States today. What's the same and how have things changed? On June 14, 1777, the Second Continental Congress passed the Flag Act of 1777, which approved the design of a new national flag. It stated, resolved, that the flag of the 13 United States be 13 stripes, alternate red and white, and the Union be 13 stars, white in a blue field, representing a new constellation. In 1916, President Woodrow Wilson established June 14th as National Flag Day. We don't have proof that Betsy Ross sewed the first American flag, but this flag made by her circa 1783 to 1795 may be the earliest known United States flag in existence. The next article is North Carolinians Make Up Their Minds by Kathleen Duval, who is a history professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She is the co-author of several books, including Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution, and the United States history textbook Give Me Liberty in American History. Duval regularly reviews books in the Wall Street Journal. She lives in Durham with her husband and sons. Have you ever seen the North Carolina license plate that says First and Freedom? Do you know where that comes from? In 1775 and 1776, it became clear that King George III and the colony of Massachusetts were going to war against each other. Protests in Boston had grown into a rebellion, and the British Army fired shots at colonists in the Massachusetts towns of Lexington and Concord. Leaders of the colony of North Carolina wrote resolutions in support of the rebellion and independence from Britain. Those men decided to join the fight against the king's taxation without representation. However, prominent, literate men were not the only North Carolinians who would have to make up their minds. North Carolinians of all kinds would have to respond to the American Revolution, a war that eventually came to their own backyards. Before the Revolution, North Carolinians considered themselves British and were loyal to the king, but they didn't like taxes. When Parliament passed the Stamp Act in 1765, people protested in the port cities of Wilmington and New Bern and in Orange County. In 1774, North Carolina leaders sent delegates to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. They decided to join a colonies-wide agreement not to import goods from Britain until demands were met. Women did most of the shopping for households then, so it was the wives, daughters, and sisters of these men whose participation in boycotting British goods would be essential. In October 1774, for example, 51 women from the Edenton area signed a resolution to boycott British goods. Women read newspapers, discuss politics, and debate independence, including what separating from Britain might do to women. Supporting boycotts and protests and declaring independence were only the beginning of a war that would be fought, partly in North Carolina. Men had to decide whether to join the fight and on which side. Rebelling and loyalist militias, as well as the Continental Army, recruited in the state. Like many other men across the state, a group of white and black men in Birdie County together signed an oath of allegiance to the new state of North Carolina and promised to defend it against the king. Many joined up with the Continental Army. In the western part of the state, though, some small farmers remained loyal to Britain because they believed the wealthy Easterners who had run the colonial assembly before the Revolution and were now calling for independence were worse tyrants than Parliament and the king. Some women joined up with the Continental Army or militias to do the kind of work that was expected of women at the time. They cooked and did the laundry for hundreds of soldiers. They nursed the sick and wounded and prepared dead soldiers' bodies for burial. And there were women who did not choose to go to war but had no choice when it came to them. As in many wars, women and children were often caught in the middle. American Indians in and on the borders of North Carolina had to decide what to do when the American Revolution broke out. On the colony's western border lay the Cherokee Nation. Their lands encompassed much of what is now western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, and northern Georgia. The Cherokee were disgusted that they could see the smoke of the Virginians from our doors as settlers squatted illegally on Cherokee lands. So when the British started to fight one another, many Cherokee decided to take advantage of the war and fight against the colonists. In contrast, members of the Catawba tribe, whose nation was on the North Carolina's southern border, sided with the rebelling colonists. They had good relations with the colonial community of Camden, South Carolina. They hoped that fighting together would continue to protect Catawba land and independence. Catawba men set off with their colonial allies to fight the British, including at the Battle of Guilford Courthouse. Catawba women fortified their towns and kept their farms producing food. When General Charles Cornwallis's troops marched toward their homes in 1780, Catawba women led their children and their elderly north to safety among the native communities in Virginia. Enslaved North Carolinians, who numbered about 70,000 by the Revolution, discussed their own liberty in the context of a war where a lot of people were talking about liberty and rights. Some of them took advantage of the turmoil of war to seize their own freedom. Some discussed organizing to overthrow their owners. Others escaped to British lines. In an effort to take manpower away from the rebelling colonists, the British Army promised freedom to any military-age men who were enslaved by rebelling colonists. Men, women, and children of all ages heard this news and escaped to British ships off the coast. Once Cornwallis's army reached South Carolina, enslaved people began fleeing to British lines and offering their services to the British Army. There were also enslaved men who fought against the British, and some of them gained their freedom for their service. An enslaved North Carolina man named Jack even freed his enslaver and other prisoners by capturing a British ship. In the American Revolution, the decisions of ordinary people mattered. Some believed deeply in the ideals of the Revolution. Others were steadfastly loyal to Britain, and many simply had to make decisions when the war came to them. Here are the captions of the accompanying photographs. Does something seem odd about this picture? It's a political cartoon called Liberty Triumphant, or The Downfall of Oppression. It depicts the Americans and the British facing each other across the Atlantic Ocean. But who's who? Normally, when we look at a map, we view it as if north is at the top, south is at the bottom, west is left, and east is at the right. But this picture is drawn as if we are looking down from the north, so the American colonies are on the right side and Britain is on the left. How far apart were the 13 colonies from England? Roughly 3,800 miles. Ships traveling across the Atlantic Ocean could take 6 to 8 weeks, depending on the weather. There are two sidebar articles. Here's the first, Women in War. Women reenactors often portray typical chores done by women camp followers. Most, but not all, accounts of the Revolutionary period were written by those in power, which frequently meant educated white men. Their perspective often reflected the then common view of women as helpful, but not central to events. We know that women's contributions were essential. At the time, white married women with children likely took on men's work in addition to their own, with their husbands away. Some married women without children accompanied their men to the front, serving as nurses, housekeepers, and cooks. Free and enslaved women of color had different, difficult choices, whether to risk enslavement or to seek freedom. For example, American Indian women, like Native men, navigated through choices to determine what was best for their communities. And the second sidebar, Friends in War? In this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian, we will talk about soldiers, battles, and the many different sides of the American Revolution. You might think that everyone was involved in fighting, but that's not quite true. For the Religious Society of Friends, also known as Friends or Quakers, the war created a unique challenge. Quakers are pacifists. That means they believe in peace and do not engage in violence. Many Friends desired political neutrality and refused to serve in the militia or in the army. But the Battle of Guilford Courthouse finally brought the war to their neighborhood. The Quaker community had to pick a side to fight on, right? Not quite. The Friends took a different route. Instead of engaging in the battle, they used their homes and meeting houses as hospitals to care for soldiers who were hurt or sick. They helped both Patriot and British soldiers because they believed that their job was at all times to assist the distressed. For Quakers in colonial North Carolina, refusing to fight may not have been popular, but standing up for what you believe in is always a good choice. There are two photographs, and here are their captions. An 1869 painting of the Friends' Meeting House in New Garden in Guilford County. Dolly Payne Todd Madison, born 1768, died 1849, was born in the New Garden settlement of what was then Rowan County. Today, that location houses Guilford College in Greensboro. Dolly Madison was a Quaker and became First Lady when her husband James Madison was elected president in 1808. The next article is A British Naval Officer and the American Revolution by Timothy Jenks, who is Associate Professor of History at East Carolina University. Would you quit a job to do what you thought was right? John Cartwright did. He gave up a career as a British naval officer because he believed in the cause of the American Revolution. Cartwright was born in England in 1740, the third son in a family of 10 children. According to the practices of the time, his eldest brother would inherit the family lands, so jobs had to be found for the other sons. His five sisters were expected to get married. But his brother Edmund became a clergyman, another became an army officer, and John himself entered the Navy in July 1758. The Seven Years' War, also known as the French and Indian War, was just breaking out between Great Britain and France. John was well placed to impress his senior officers with the heroic acts that earned promotion. His exploits off the coast of France brought him to the attention of an admiral, Lord Howe, whose patronage and connections advanced Cartwright's career. Patronage is support from a wealthy or influential person. John was promoted to lieutenant and given command of his own ship, the Spy. What ruined John Cartwright's promising naval career? The coming of the American Revolution. It is a bit of a myth to think that all the people in Britain supported the policies of King George III and his Prime Minister, Lord North. Just as it is a bit of a myth to think that all the colonists supported the Sons of Liberty. And John was one of many people in Britain who had sympathy for the colonists. What made John Cartwright different was that he published his pro-American thoughts in a pamphlet, American Independence, The Glory and Interests of Great Britain, appeared in 1774, just as the American crisis was reaching its fever pitch. Because he feared the consequences for his career, Cartwright published the pamphlet anonymously, without using his real name. In it, he argued for the principle of colonial self-government and the right to self-taxation. These beliefs put Cartwright in a difficult position when Britain went to war with the 13 colonies. His patron, Lord Howe, was organizing a fleet to sail to America, and he offered Cartwright a position as an officer. If Cartwright had taken it, he might have spent the war earning greater success and more promotion. But Cartwright was forced to decline because his conscience could not accept the idea of serving in a war against America. "That would have been a desertion of my principles," he wrote in his letter of reply to Howe. Days later, he publicly acknowledged he was the author of American Independence, and John Cartwright's naval career was over. Cartwright was 35 years old and out of a job, so he turned to the profession that had cost him his career in the Navy. Political activism. Activism is an action that a person takes to bring about political or social change. Cartwright, over the next 40 years until he died in 1824, became one of Britain's leading radical politicians. Radicals were very critical of the British government and advocated wholesale reform of its institutions. Cartwright was especially interested in the reform of Parliament, the legislature he felt had triggered the American Revolution. A good number of people in Britain felt the way that John Cartwright did about the American Revolution. Not all of them lost their jobs or published pamphlets like he did, but they did express their opposition. They did so by signing petitions to Parliament in which they called upon George III to reverse his policies and avoid war. A number of leading politicians also opposed the war. Today, some of these politicians are remembered in the names of the North Carolina counties of Pitt, Chatham, and Rockingham. As it turned out, if John Cartwright had stayed in the British Navy, he would have had a difficult war. The Royal Navy was in poor condition and had to face the combined sea power of France and Spain, who had entered the war on the side of the colonists. Largely because of the difficulties its navy faced, Britain came out on the losing side of the Revolutionary War. Today, there are statues of the heroes of the American Revolution all across the United States. And in London, there is a statue of John Cartwright. But his statue would not exist were it not for the American Revolution, which changed the world and John Cartwright's path in life. Here are the captions for the accompanying photographs. Frederick North, 2nd Earl of Guildford, known as Lord North, born 1732, died 1792, was Prime Minister of Great Britain from 1770 to 1782. He led Great Britain through most of the American War of Independence. North Carolina's Guildford County was named after his father, Francis North, 1st Earl of Guildford. Memorial to Major John Cartwright, known as the Father of Reform, erected in London in 1831, in what was later renamed Cartwright Gardens. John Cartwright, born 1740, died 1824, British naval officer, political reformer, and author of the pro-America pamphlet American Independence, The Glory and Interest of Great Britain. Cartwright was the first English writer to openly support American independence. From the Stories from Our Collections article, Powderhorn, late 1770s. Revolutionary War soldiers had to carry the gunpowder for their muskets in a separate container to keep it safe, dry, and ready to load when needed. Many soldiers used a powder horn for this, and most of those were made from actual animal horns. This example is from a cow. Joel Lane, born 1740, died 1795, used this intricately carved powder horn during the war. Lane is known as the founding father of both Raleigh and Wake County. His home is now a historic site in Raleigh. Washington Statue, 1910. George Washington, born 1732, died 1799, served as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army and the first President of the United States. In the early 1800s, the North Carolina Assembly voted to honor him with a statue in the state capitol. Italian sculptor Antonio Canova carved a marble statue of Washington in Roman military clothing. General Marquis de Lafayette visited the statue in 1825, as seen in this engraving. But in 1831, the Capitol caught fire, and the statue was destroyed. In 1910, the Italian government discovered the artist's original mold and presented to North Carolina this plaster version, which is now in the museum's collection. Plate, mid-1700s. What does a broken plate have to do with a Revolutionary War battle? British officers often traveled and camped in relative luxury with nice furniture and even fancy dishes. Colonel Joseph McDowell from North Carolina reportedly took this plate from British Colonel Patrick Ferguson's baggage after Ferguson was killed during the Battle of Kings Mountain in 1780. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Please be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long, until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138.